Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is John Barry. He's a New York Times best-selling writer whose books have won literally dozens of awards. He's the only non-scientist ever to win one particular honor from the National Academy of Sciences. And in 2005, the New York Public Library named his book Rising Tide one of the best 50 best books of the preceding 50 years. His books also got him directly involved in public policy. So first off, thank you for your work, and second, thanks for being on the program.
Well, thanks for those comments, and I'm very pleased to be on with you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks. So let's talk about the coastal wetlands of Louisiana. Can you talk about how they were, what they used to be like, what has happened to them, and how are they now?
Well, first, to understand the problem in Louisiana, you have to understand the geology. The Gulf of Mexico used to go up to Cape Girardeau, Missouri. All the land from there to the present mouth of the river was made by the deposit of sediment of the Mississippi River. So there is no rocks jutting out. There are no cliffs anywhere on the Louisiana coast. In total, the Mississippi River and its tributaries made about 40,000 square miles of land. There are roughly 8,000 square miles that are considered coastal Louisiana, or were considered coastal Louisiana. 2,000 square miles of that 8,000 square miles, in other words, about 25%, has disappeared in the last 70 or so years. And it's continuing to disappear, melt into the ocean, essentially, at the rate of a football field every 45 minutes or so. And that rate may very well accelerate. These problems were caused by many, had many causes. Sea level rise has not yet been one of the problems. It will be a problem in the future. At risk is the entire port infrastructure of the lower Mississippi River, which includes three of the 10 biggest ports in the United States by weight. 60% of the grain exports go down the Mississippi River. That's at risk. There are tens of billions of dollars of oil and gas infrastructure that is exposed by this land loss to greater risk from hurricanes. After Katrina, gas prices shot up $1 a gallon. People probably don't remember that, just because some of those refineries and some of the infrastructure was knocked out. If you live in the Northeast, anywhere from Portland, Maine, Boston, Providence, New York, Washington, the natural gas, and you use natural gas, that comes straight up from Orleans Parish in Louisiana on a pipeline. So your natural gas supplies are jeopardized by this land loss, and so on and so on and so on.
So how was the land created in the first place, and what are the causes of the loss? I know that, for example, when they erect dams on rivers, that causes sediment to not be able to flow down and will destroy beaches at the lower end. Is that part of what's going on with the Mississippi?
That is certainly part of the problem. The Mississippi River used to dump roughly 400 million tons of sediment a year into the mouth of the river, and this would gradually build out land. That is a process that makes the land, make the land being made in Louisiana as fragile and as fresh as any land in the world. Human engineering has interfered with that process. You mentioned one of the issues. Most of the sediment that used to come down the Mississippi River came from the Missouri River. The Missouri is actually the Big Muddy, although a lot of people tend to refer to the Mississippi as the Big Muddy incorrectly. However, there were dams on the Missouri which retained all that sediment. There is now roughly 200 million tons of sediment that the Mississippi River delivers to the Gulf of Mexico. And half of what's missing is coming from the Missouri. According to the Corps of Engineers, there are 40,000 dams on the entire Mississippi River system. And when you think of the Mississippi, you may think of a straight line from Minnesota flowing past New Orleans to the Gulf. But it actually drains 31 states and two Canadian provinces. The Mississippi River system goes from almost Buffalo, New York in the east to the Rocky Mountains in the west. And on that entire system, the Corps says there are 40,000 dams. There are six dams on the upper Missouri River and a handful more on the Platte that basically account for the subtraction of 100 million tons of sediment a year from the Mississippi, while the other 39,990 dams and the rest of the country, they do have some impact, but all of them cumulatively only add up to about what those handful of tiny, tiny handful of dams on the Missouri retain. But that's only part of the problem. And that is very much a slower kill, a long-term issue. Another major problem is the levying of the river. You build those levees and that prevents the river from flooding, so which means it prevents the river from carrying sediment and spreading it out over the entire natural floodplain of the river, in which would sustain the land and keep it from sinking, because it would, every time it floods, it would drop 4 to 5 inches of sediment across the floodplain. So that's another major problem. And another key is the oil and gas industry. The industry has dredged roughly 10,000 miles of pipelines and canals through the Louisiana marsh. Every inch of those pipelines and canals allows saltwater intrusion. As I said at the beginning, there are no rocks, no cliffs, things like that on the Louisiana coast. It's just basically mud held together by roots of plants. The saltwater intrusion kills the plants. They no longer hold the soil together, and it just melts into the ocean. Another oil and gas related cause is simply the extraction of so much volume of material from underneath the earth, just like sucking on a straw, that the earth simply subsides. It sinks. So it sinks below sea level. And again, this is not related to the sea level rise, which is a future problem. This is just subsidence, which has been ongoing from the extraction of oil and gas from underneath the ground. So the interesting part of this is that almost from the beginning of when oil and gas started doing this, it was recognized that they would create a problem. And the permits and state laws under which the industry has operated has required the industry to basically fix the damage which it causes. And it has never done that. I could quote one of the state regulations, which says, restore to the pre-existing condition, unquote. You couldn't be more explicit than that. But the industry has never done anything like that whatsoever. Louisiana has been dominated politically by the oil and gas industry. Like few states have ever been dominated by any one industry. Maybe West Virginia and coal might be similar, but that's about the only one that I could think of. Texas obviously has huge oil and gas operations, but in Texas, their influence is diluted because there are so many other things going on. But in Louisiana, you really only have two things, the port and the oil and gas industry. Petrochemical industry is big too, but that relates to oil and gas. So politically, they have prevented the state from ever enforcing its regulations. For example, the Department of Natural Resources has 6 inspectors, and there are 58,000 wells in Louisiana. And 6 is actually an increase. They used to have 2. So you cannot expect those inspectors to regulate the industry. There's simply not enough people. And as you said in your introduction, I've gotten involved in public policy. After Katrina, I was appointed to the levee board that protects metropolitan New Orleans. And this was a new type of creation, really unlike any other levee board in the country. It required a state constitutional amendment to create it. And because most of the flooding in the city of New Orleans after Katrina was the result of a design failure by the Corps of Engineers, and the old levee board did not have really anybody on it who was capable of looking at what the Corps did and critiquing it, they created an entirely new institution, which was science-based. The levee board had on it people like a past president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, the chairman of a National Academy of Sciences working group on coastal risk reduction, the author of textbooks, college textbooks, basically engineers and scientists. I am not an engineer or a scientist, but I did have a pretty good understanding of flooding. And this levee board, technically it's called the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East, filed a lawsuit in 2013 against 97 oil, gas, and pipeline companies for coastal land loss. And our argument was the destruction of this buffer land outside the levee system increases storm surge against the levees, and we wanted the industry to restore this buffer zone so that the city of New Orleans and the rest of coastal Louisiana would be better protected naturally. I mean, if you think about it for a second, you know, we lost 2,000 square miles. That's as big as Delaware, actually slightly larger than Delaware. If you put the state of Delaware between New Orleans and the ocean, New Orleans wouldn't need any levees, any hurricane protection whatsoever. But you take that land away, and as land loss continues to increase, then essentially you're going to have ocean waves breaking right on the levees, which is not a sustainable situation. New Orleans could not survive that. So we filed the lawsuit. It was a huge deal politically in the state of Louisiana, and big political fight and so forth, and that's still ongoing. And in fact, I've oversimplified it vastly. So maybe we'll get into it later.
So before we talk more about the lawsuit, it's about the troubles with the lawsuit and the resistance to it. Can you be clear for me again on the suit was against Exxon, Mobil, Shell, BP, all these 93 other oil, gas, and pipeline companies, and so are they the if you had to link out how much damage is caused by the oil and gas industry to the loss of wetlands versus the dams or levees, what percentage is the oil and gas industry's responsibility with their canalization and pipelines, et cetera, that allow the intrusion, saltwater intrusion?
Of course, that actually would vary spot to spot.
Of course.
On the coast. But the numbers that I normally quote are ones that the industry's own scientists have signed off on, so there can be no dispute. The reality is that there are a lot of scientists who think the damage is a lot greater than these sort of consensus views, but there was a U.S. Geological Survey study which included industry scientists. As I say, the industry signed off on this conclusion that basically said 36% of the land loss was a result of industry activities. That was around 2000. Going back to 1972, there was a study by pipeline companies, again, the industry's own study, which concluded that for every mile of pipeline, 54 acres of land were destroyed. And again, there are thousands of miles of both pipelines and canals. Canals would actually probably do worse damage than the pipelines because they're a lot wider. There are 37 to 38 studies, scientific studies, a fair number of them entirely by the industry. Every single one of them concludes that the industry is a major contributor. The canals themselves, physically, there are so many canals, just the volume of the canals, the space they take up, accounts for 11% of the total land loss. And the canals' indirect causes, the saltwater intrusion and all the other stuff, is actually considerably worse than the direct physical space that the canals take up. So you're really talking about at least a third of the land loss. And there are reputable scientists, including the Shell professor of oceanography at LSU, who thinks that the oil and gas industry is responsible for more like 80% of the land loss.
So before we get to the state resistance to the lawsuit, the political resistance to it, I want to give you the opportunity to do like a 3-minute love story or love letter to the wetlands themselves, because I've heard so many people from Louisiana and so many people who have history in Louisiana who have talked about how that is one of their favorite places, was one of their favorite places in the world, just incredibly rich biologically and beautiful and everything else. So do you want to do like a just short sort of love letter to the wetlands at all?
Well, I'm not much of a romantic. At least I write better than I talk. But I will say that, I mean, they are beautiful. You know, the lushness of them, their richness is extraordinary. 96% of the fish in the Gulf of Mexico depend on Louisiana wetlands for some part of their life cycle. So they're extraordinarily important from the perspective of the fisheries. You know, not just a question of tourism. There is I think everybody recognizes, everybody around the world recognizes that there is a culture in Louisiana on the coast, which is unlike any other in the United States. Obviously, I'm talking about Cajuns. There are Native Americans that have a different life there than anywhere else. It is just an entirely unique place. That's a little redundant to say entirely unique, but maybe redundancy isn't a bad thing in this instance. You know, there's nothing like it. Certainly, and it's 8,000 square miles, or was 8,000 square miles. Now it's down to about 6.
And I've heard wonderful things about the birds too. That it's a migratory flyway. That's
for sure. Yeah, you know, straight down from Canada, and I'm not very good at this part of the podcast.
No, you're doing great. It's and the thing that I didn't know, the thing about, what did you say, 93% of the fish?
96% of the species in the Gulf.
Yeah,
depend on that part of the ecosystem for some part of their lifestyle.
That's extraordinary.
You know, if you take that away, a lot changes. Earlier, I was talking about the economic impact on the country, ranging from, you know, farmers in the upper Midwest who ship their exports down the river to the Northeast with the natural gas, but in you know, the refinery, 20% of the refining capacity in the country is in Louisiana. If you take that away, and almost every one of them is vulnerable to a hurricane storm surge, you take them out of the equation and gas prices and so forth. But the biological impact of the loss of the wetlands cannot be replicated. You know, you can perhaps adjust sooner or later to the economic impact, but that biological loss, that cannot be restored anywhere else.
So it's safe to say that can we say, and I'm being ironic here, can we say that the state of New Orleans, the state of Louisiana was happily greeted the lawsuit filed against the oil industry? They welcomed this oversight.
You did make me laugh. The funny thing is, the people in Louisiana actually did support the lawsuit. The principle is pretty simple. You break something, you're supposed to fix it, particularly when you agreed in your permits and under state law that you have a responsibility to fix it. But the industry has escaped that responsibility for decades. And we tried to make them accountable. We did poll the issue. This became a huge issue in the state legislature. The last governor, Bobby Jindal, a joke, who ran for president, and I've known Bobby for a long time before he ever ran for office. And well, that's an aside. I won't get into that right now. We don't have time. Jindal wanted us to withdraw the lawsuit within almost minutes after we filed it. He demanded that we withdraw it. But our levy board, I said earlier, required a constitutional amendment to set it up. We were unlike almost any other board in the state of Louisiana, because once we were appointed and confirmed by the state Senate, we could not be replaced except for cause. All the other levy boards in the state, the governor would have simply replaced every member of the board and they would have withdrawn the lawsuit. But he couldn't touch us. That was part of the post-Katrina reform. So the state legislature, there was a very large fight the following year. And there was an effort to pass 19 different pieces of legislation, each one of which took a different angle of attack to kill the lawsuit. We did poll. This was highly politicized, obviously. And the support for the lawsuit was very solid and remains solid, roughly 2-1 in favor of the lawsuit, in favor of making the industry abide by the law. But that did not, those poll numbers did not translate into the state legislature. We did manage to kill 18 of the bills that were designed to kill the lawsuit, but one did pass. Interestingly, immediately after it passed, the attorney general of the state called upon the governor to veto it. There were over 100 law professors signed a letter to the governor from all over the country advising him to veto it because it had all sorts of dangerous things in there. It was written in such haste to get it through a committee that it was extremely dangerous. He did not veto it. He signed it, but it was the state court has already thrown the law out, saying it was so poorly written it was unconstitutional on three separate grounds. And, in fact, did not even apply to the levy board, which it was aimed at. So we passed that test. there are a lot of other things going on. After we filed, several parishes in Louisiana, a county in another state is a parish in Louisiana. Several parishes have filed, five in total, and we have a new governor. And the new governor, John Bel Edwards, was our strongest supporter in the state legislature, and has made crystal clear to the industry that he intends that they should obey the law, and the state will take legal action if more coastal parishes do not. There are five that have sued so far. There are about 20. He has suggested to those parishes which have not sued that if they do not take action, the state will take action on their behalf. And the state has also joined in the lawsuits that the five parishes who have filed already have started. So there is now legal pressure on the industry to do something. So far, they have not done anything except resist.
So before I ask what can be done, and there's another direction I want to go in a second too, having to do with your book about Roger Williams. But before that, can you give us a short history of, you mentioned it, but can you give a short history of industry control of the state? Because I think, you mentioned it, and then also Louisiana is just notorious for this. And anybody, for example, who's read James Lee Burke, who writes about that constantly in his novels, and there are other people who've written about just the extreme control. Can you talk about that a little bit, just the history of it? Give us a couple minutes.
Well, some of it is, simply the Department of Natural Resources, which is supposed to regulate the industry. As I said, they only have six inspectors, 58,000 wells. That's not an accident. There was a saying that the flag of Texaco flies over the Louisiana Capitol. Of course, Texaco doesn't exist anymore. It's now Chevron, part of Chevron. It hasn't necessarily been the outright corruption or violence of, say, the John Grisham novel, The Pelican Brief. It's more that nobody opposes them. Because whenever anything comes up, they will get all the industry workers in an area and go flood a parish council meeting, for example. I mentioned a minute ago that the governor has told various coastal parishes if they do not take legal action, then the state will act on their behalf. So the industry is simply flooded every time the parish council meets. They make sure that all these oil workers show up at the parish council meeting and scream and holler, and the parish council votes against taking legal action. So there's plenty of bullying going on. There was, for example, in one parish that did sue, Plaquemine Parish, one of the councilman's business, he ran a restaurant, was boycotted. And he basically surrendered and reversed himself. So there are all sorts of pressures that the industry puts on, and most of it is legal. I'm not accusing them of outright bribery. They make fewer campaign contributions than you might expect. Because there are so many people who are dependent on them for jobs, and it's actually more effective to get those people to call a state legislator than it is simply to make a campaign contribution. But when necessary, obviously, they have the financial resources to spend whatever it takes. For example, after the levy board filed the lawsuit, I my term expired. Not surprisingly, I was not reappointed by the governor. But I went around the state speaking at Rotary clubs and so forth, trying to get these people to call their state legislators and support and the fact that, you know, don't pass the law killing the lawsuit. And the industry organized sort of an AstroTurf group called Grow Louisiana. You know, they would have meetings and offer people free lunches and, you know, a chance at $1,000 prizes at raffles and so forth just to draw a big crowd and sign all these people up and then, you know, send something to that state legislator from that district. So I said it's kind of like AstroTurf as opposed to real grassroots organizing, but they had the resources to do that and, you know, advertising campaigns and things like that about how wonderful they are and how much they love the wetlands and how much they're doing for the wetlands. So, you know, that's a campaign that people see through, and yet it still has some effectiveness. There just are not a lot of people with the courage, with politicians, I should say, politicians, with the courage to stand up to that pressure, because they know the industry will go after you and beat you. There is one state legislator, for example. The way it works, if you want to speak to somebody in the who's on the floor, you send a note into him and he'll come out. And there was one oil industry lobbyist who sent a note into one state legislator who took like 6 or 7 minutes to come out of off the floor. And this guy didn't want to wait 6 or 7 minutes, and his comment was, that boy doesn't want to get reelected. And in fact, they imported somebody and spent several hundred thousand dollars to beat that state legislator. That's a lot of money in a state legislative race in Louisiana, where media is very, very cheap in that particular district.
So let's pretend that the lawsuit succeeds tomorrow somehow, that it's you win on every level. It goes to the Supreme Court or the oil companies settle. What do you actually want them to do? You've said you want them to. You quoted the law in the state about you have to put it back where
restore it was. To the pre-existing condition, right?
And what would be involved in actual restoration? What do you want them to do?
Well, the reality is most of the land that is gone forever. It would take almost an infinite amount of money to return it to restore it. However, the state does have what it calls a master plan. After Katrina, it created a state authority, the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, which I served on for 6 years until the governor removed me from that, which did develop a master plan on what to do. The plan has been praised by environmentalists and scientists and has a chance of working. And what it would do would be restore land in front of populated areas like New Orleans, but not only New Orleans. There are other cities like Lake Charles and the western part of the state and so forth that are threatened by land loss, and recreate that buffer in key strategic areas. That much is doable, so that you could basically significantly slow further land loss and rebuild land in key places. And depending on how bad sea level rise gets, if it's a worst case scenario comes true, the Louisiana coast, including New Orleans, is gone. So are Miami and New York and basically every coastal city in the world. But if it's not the worst case projections for sea level rise in the future, then there is a reasonable chance that this master plan will work and that coastal Louisiana will have a sustainable future. You know, a lot of it involves doing basically what built the land in the first place, and that is getting sediment out of the Mississippi River. You would build diversions which basically are holes in the levees to let sediment pour out of the river. You would direct that sediment. You would maximize the exploitation of the sediment that's left in the river. Most of the studies have concluded that there, even though it's been cut roughly in half, there is an adequate supply of sediment to do what is necessary. You might carry it through slurry pipelines for tens of miles. There is another river called the Atchafalaya, which breaks off from the Mississippi and moves out to the west. You would use the Atchafalaya. In fact, land is being built at the mouth of the Atchafalaya even today, right now, because of the sediment coming down it. But there are things that can be done with a combination of diversions and pipelines primarily. Yeah. Those would be the long-term and medium-term solutions. Short-term and, so, you know, pretty small and specific areas, you could do things like, put rocks along the shoreline to prevent erosion and so forth. That is definitely not even a medium term, much less a long term solution. But in more or less emergency type situations, that would be useful. Other things like rebuilding oyster reefs, barrier islands, things like that. All that's part of the coastal master plan. And I am an optimist, and I think there is a good chance of its working, certainly a reasonable chance of its working.
So let's go a different direction and sort of an unintuitive question. What is the relationship between everything we've been saying and your book, Roger Williams and the Creation of the American Soul, Church, State, and the Birth of Liberty?
You know, it's funny that somebody asked me that question soon after we filed the lawsuit. And my first response was, you know, there's nothing that has no relationship whatsoever to the lawsuit. And then I thought for a second, and actually it's fundamental. One of the main figures in that book is a gentleman named Sir Edward Cook, whom most of your audience never heard of. But he was probably the greatest judge in English history. He set precedents on habeas corpus, judicial review of legislative acts. You can't try someone for the same crime twice. And he is also the person who ruled from the bench that the house of everyone is as his castle. And although none of your listener, not none, but few of your listeners probably ever heard of Cook, probably every one of them is familiar with the idea that a man's home is his castle. And he actually decreed that from the bench. And what that really means, and when he said it, there were real lords with real castles and real private armies. And what he was saying was, this lord with a castle and a private army, when it came to the law, he was equal to the peasant with the poorest mud hut in England. Before the law, they were equal. Nobody was above the law. And what our situation in Louisiana today comes down to is the same thing. That even in Louisiana, even the oil industry is not above the law. So, you know, the hope is the courts will see it that way, and that there will not be procedural escape hatches for the industry. They are certainly have plenty of very, very well-paid and, I'm sure, very good lawyers who are looking for escape hatches at every opportunity. We will see as that plays out.
So what is the near-term future for not just the wetlands, but also the lawsuit?
Well, again, there are, at this point, numerous different plaintiffs. There are five parishes who are suing actually under far more different grounds than the levy board filed under. The levy board's lawsuit is awaiting a decision on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, Federal Court of Appeals. The oral arguments were February 29th, so a decision is actually overdue. It could come at any minute. And it could kill the lawsuit. It could send it back to state court. It could send it back to district court, the federal district court. And we hope the right thing for it to do is to send it back to a state court, which is where we originally filed. If that were to happen, there would be added tremendous leverage to the governor's position and to the whole effort to bring this thing to a conclusion. When we filed, we did not want to spend 8, 10, 15, 20 years in court. What we wanted was to precipitate a negotiation with a voluntary settlement, everybody getting together at the table in a statewide deal, and work something out with the industry. Nobody wants to spend the length of time in court that it would take to resolve these issues in a lawsuit. Whether that will happen remains to be seen. I think in terms of pressure on the industry, if the Fifth Circuit rules favorably on the levy board's lawsuit, that will add tremendous pressure to the industry. But, you know, we don't know how they're going to rule. We are very optimistic. We think we had by far the best arguments, and we will see. But even if that lawsuit dies, then the Paris lawsuits are definitely going to go forward. There was a lot more creative lawyering that went into the levy board lawsuit in terms of standing, in terms of the claims we were making. The parishes are narrower and much clearer on standing. And they will survive regardless of what happens to the original lawsuit filed by the levy board.
So what can individuals or collectives who maybe listening to this interview, if they care about wetlands in Louisiana, what can they do to assist either lawsuits or the wetlands themselves?
Well, one thing they could do is make sure that their federal representatives in Congress are aware of the problem. You would be amazed how easy it is actually to get the attention of an elected official in Washington. You know, most people seem to think these people pay no attention whatsoever, but if they get several letters on an issue that are legitimate issues, not AstroTurf, as I said earlier. I mean, you can tell the difference when you're in congressional office, whether or not something is generated by some kind of campaign, or whether or not it's actually an individual voice, someone who cares. So this is a national issue. Those dams on the upper Missouri River, they provide hydropower and flood control and irrigation for people living in very red states, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Missouri, Kansas. If those people realize that the protection they get from floods, that the power they get when they turn the lights on, actually damages coastal Louisiana, you know, I'm not necessarily saying tear down those dams, but it does, I think, create a responsibility there for people to support rebuilding coastal Louisiana. There certainly is a federal role. We've talked mostly about the oil and gas industry But there are other causes besides the oil and gas industry for the land loss, and they are a national responsibility. For example, we haven't mentioned shipping. There are jetties that extend 2.5 miles out into the Gulf of Mexico that carry an awful lot of the sediment that remains in the river and dumps it into deep water where it is no longer available to build land. That shipping, anybody who has anything that's imported or exported through the Mississippi River is benefiting from that, yet coastal Louisiana is bearing 100% of the cost. So there's a very good example of a national benefit and a reason why the federal government does have a responsibility to make a contribution to restoring the coast. So I would say that's probably number one.
Well, thank you. Is there? We've got like 2 minutes left or a minute left. And is there anything else you've wanted to say about these issues that I haven't given you the opportunity?
Not really, depending on the timing. I mean, I don't know when this is going to run, so this is probably shouldn't be something I'm saying right now. But there is a Democrat running for the United States Senate named Foster Campbell. The runoff election is December 10th. If this runs before then, send him a contribution. It will make a difference.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for everything you've said. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been John Barry. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.